I'm Elena Landsberg-Lewis, your host of Grandmothers on the Move, the podcast that kicks old stereotypes to the curb. Come meet these creative, outrageous, authentic, adventurous, irreverent, and powerful disruptors and influencers. Grandmothers, from the living room to the courtroom, making powerful contributions in every walk of life. We know them most intimately as loving caregivers, the older women in our lives with a thousand stories about their grandchildren and pictures in their purses. In this podcast, you'll come to know even more about our grandmothers. They are galvanized, determined, and are guaranteed to get you thinking. What drives them? What are they up to? What is the potential of grandmother power, and how is it changing the world? Grandmothers are on the move. You don't want to be left behind. Hi, it's Elena. Welcome back to Grandmothers on the Move. And today I have exciting and interesting news. I have a sponsor for the first time since the beginning of this podcast, She Changed News, a newsletter for women over 60, well, women of all ages, really, with extraordinarily interesting information about older women and grandmothers on the move around the world. Check it out at shechangednews.com. And now let me launch into a really special conversation with a dear friend, Patsy George. Patsy retired from the public service in British Columbia in 2001, and her work in public welfare, child welfare, and community development, including as director of multiculturalism and immigrant and settlements services, BC, a long and illustrious career organizing the Solidarity Coalition, working with the BC Federation of Labor to fight government cutbacks, serving on the Immigration and Refugee Board of Canada, acting as a member of the community panel to review family and children's services legislation in BC. Patsy and I talk about her commitment to human rights, women's and children's rights, capacity building, and community development is solid, evident, inspiring throughout her extraordinary service, including the international sphere, where she worked with the United Nations Associations in Canada as a volunteer, with Canadian Crossroads International, serving on their board. As a treasured and much valued member of the original founding board of directors of the Stephen Lewis Foundation, Patsy's many contributions have been recognized with honors and awards, both the Golden and Diamond Jubilee Medals, the Order of British Columbia, and the Order of Canada. I first met Patsy when she was on the board of directors of the Stephen Lewis Foundation, and I am privileged and honored to call her a friend and a mentor.
Welcome to Grandmothers on the Move, Patsy. It's such a pleasure to have this time together.
Wonderful. I'm so happy that I can be with you as someone who had so much to do with the opening of this particular movement in Canada. So I'm delighted to be chatting with you, my dear.
Oh, thank you. As I said in the introduction, you've been one of my mentors and guiding lights. Patsy is one of the founding members of the board of the Stephen Lewis Foundation. So we've had many, many years of wonderful meeting of minds and learning and comradeship. Yes. But, and it occurred to me, you know, why aren't I speaking to one of the older women in my life, activists in my life, who actually had such a formative influence? I think of you as a friend. And then I thought, but others should hear from you, Patsy.
So, well, I think you're being very, very kind. I tell you, you know, it is really amazing that this whole movement of grandmothers across Canada has been such a successful movement. You know, I'm very much in touch with the grandmothers in this part of Canada. And every time I talk to one of them or every time I attend any event, you know, it makes me so inspired and so happy that we as group of women in Canada can be so passionate about the conditions that women in Africa face, and then how important it is for us to be working so that they are able to take charge of their lives and all their children and their grandchildren. And it is such a wonderful community spirit, not only a local community, but a global community, you know, and that's what is so wonderful about this movement, I find. And all of them that I know personally, they are active women. They have their own lives, and yet they are willing to take the time because they really and truly believe that this is one world. We are responsible for each other, and that how important it is for us to support the women who are going through terrible time. They're fighting not only, you know, poverty, but also fighting government restrictions and fighting men who are abusing them. All of those horrible stuff that happened to women, not only in conflict situations, but even in everyday life. So it's wonderful that the Canadian women have taken such a passionate approach. And I think raising funds in Canada to support some of the projects that the grandmothers are involved in and that they would want to really take up the cause. And I'm happy to be part of that movement. And I certainly am proud of the fact that I was there, you know, as we founded this organization. So I'm quite happy. And I tell you, just this last week, in fact, I was in touch with the group of Go-Go's from Burnaby. They have been raising money by making these bags, beautiful handmade stuff. And of course, they post it on Facebook. And I would not only give them compliments, but I also buy them. In fact, today, I was wearing a mask with the Go-Go symbol, because that's another thing that they're promoting, you know, and so they take advantage of whatever is happening locally to promote. It's not just us. There are people like us in Africa who are also going through this. And so we need to figure out how we are going to support. And the other day, I was talking to somebody in Victoria. Do you know, during this COVID period, they're training people to go on a bicycle ride in order to raise money, because not everyone is comfortable doing that kind of stuff. It's just creative. It's so wonderful. I'm sorry, I can go on and on chatting this way, but...
No, that's the point.
And the other thing that one of the other groups in BC did, you know, they made soup. In a group of 8 or 9 women, made different kinds of soups. And so if I were to join to watch them on a Zoom, then I get the recipes at the end of the session. So I have a whole bunch of new recipes for soups that I can make during the winter. I mean, you know, creative, isn't
it? So creative. Well, and one of the things that was extraordinarily meaningful, very inspiring to me, was the way in which Canadian grandmothers and grandothers, as they call themselves.
Yeah.
Who want women of grandmothering age who want to join in, and it embraces and includes so many others. The way that older women in particular were able to embrace with real thoughtfulness the notion that this was not a campaign of charity, but it was really about solidarity with older women in Africa, dignified experts on what it's going to take to recover from the AIDS pandemic, to raise their orphaned grandchildren and the children in their communities, and really embrace this notion that there is a way to be supportive from the North without dehumanizing the expert women at the grassroots in Africa.
Exactly. And I also find it very interesting that the groups that I visit and obviously support them, you know, in whatever actions that they're taking locally to raise money, they work as a collective. There is no hierarchy, you know, but it's quite interesting to see that everybody is equal and everyone takes on different roles. And it's quite interesting to see that whole development, I find.
You know, Patsy, you've been involved in working on behalf of marginalized, disenfranchised newcomers to Canada, immigrant women and women of color in so many different capacities. I mean, I was looking at your bio, I was thinking, you know, you always learn something new and marvelous about the people you respect and love when you read their bios. You know, and I was thinking, there's so much. You've come at it from the perspective of social work. You've come at it from Quebec to Nova Scotia, district supervisor, manager of programs on community development. You organize the Solidarity Coalition, which I'm dying to hear more about. You worked with the BC Federation of Labor. Like, when I look at the amount that you did, I think you were in the Provincial Ministry of Multiculturalism and Immigration, right?
That's I was the director.
Right. And you were also, of course, appointed to the Immigration and Refugee Board of Canada for a few years.
Non-lawyer,
Yes, which was really, you know, it's exceptional. Covered 1/100th of the different things that you've done. The Pacific Immigrant Resources Society that you started and you were president. There's just so many different ways in which you have worked long before these words were in the daily lexicon as they are now around intersectionality, inclusion, diversity, equality. And I wonder, when you look back on so many years of fighting the good fight, but also raising the voices and the issues of women living at the margins and marginalized, what is your reflection? How do you feel about that when you connect all
of that? Well, you know, I think that having a social democratic philosophical background, you know, that's very helpful, because I grew up in a home where both my parents had those views, those ideals. But also as a person who was trained in community development, what my approach has always been, that when I'm working with a person or with a group of people, you know, what I'm doing is assisting them to reflect on what their own issues are. And then they are able to come up with what their solutions are. And my job is to support them to find those resources and help them change the policies. So it's really encouraging and supporting and making it possible for them to do their own fighting. I'm not doing it for them. They are doing it. And that's where I think I've been able to make the contribution, because then people know that I'm not there as a public servant or as a leader. I'm not their spokesperson. I am there behind the scenes supporting them so that they can speak for themselves. And part of it has to do with my respect and my belief in the human being. We have inside ourselves, we do have the strength. Because of poverty and because of racism and because of structural stuff that we have created to keep people down, that has really kept a lot of people outside the system, or they have never felt that they could really achieve. But the strength is there. Matter of really helping somebody to recognize, you know, what are the issues and how can that be described? Am I at fault, or is the system needs to recognize to accommodate myself and a group of people? You know, whether it is a neighborhood, whether it is parents of a school kid, whether it is a group of people of color, or if it is new immigrants, I think it's a matter of working with those individuals and groups to recognize not just the issues that they're facing, but their own strengths and how can they support each other and become a strong advocate for themselves. And then they feel they're making the change. And in the long run, they will continue to do it. They will teach their children how to do it. They teach their neighbors how to do it. And so it's a matter of trying to strengthen our communities, you know, in the long run. And I think that's what works for me. And I think I've been very lucky that I chose the profession I did, because I think it is compatible with the kind of ideology that I have, that you are not doing the work, you are assisting that person to do it themselves. And so they become stronger and they become confident and they realize that they have the power. That's the approach I've always taken, whether I'm working one-to-one or whether I'm working with a community or a group of people. That's something that is part of me, you know, and I'm not looking for any kind of position of power, because, you know, they had always invited me to apply for more senior positions. I never did, because I would lose this kind of a work that I enjoy doing and feeling identified with the local communities and looking back and feeling good about, gee, that group was able to get the school to change those policies because they were able to work as a group. And I'm glad that I brought them together as a group. That kind of stuff behind the scenes. So I'm more of an organizer, and that's why I was so successful with Solidarity Coalition, because my job at that point was to bring the professional communities, the associations of professional psychologists, social workers, the church community, all of those various groups in the community who were not necessarily identified with the labor movement. And at the same time, it was obvious that the government bringing in these horrible policies was going to affect everybody. And the interesting thing for me is that, you know, my personal and my political, it's very close. I was very lucky to have both. I can combine my political interests and my personal interests.
You make it sound so easy, but the reality is that,
yeah.
And I'm framing it this way, so correct me if this doesn't resonate for you, but when I look at all the different things that you've done,
yeah.
It's so interesting because you really figured out a way to balance
yeah.
the civil servant, public servant
yeah.
piece of
yeah.
it. You with an incredibly tenacious activist heart, right?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
so often we see civil servants or public servants as
yeah.
very separate from community, very separate from activism. Obviously, in
yeah.
fact, you're not even supposed yeah. to be identified in that way. And
yeah.
yet, I know you took a leave of absence yeah. to organize.
I had no choice at that point. Yeah.
Of course,
yeah.
in the 80s.
You can't organize protest rallies against your employer.
Exactly. That would have been very interesting, too. But in some ways, you did, because you took a leave and you went back.
It was never that easy within government, though, you know, because mm-hmm. this is why I'm a strong unionist I felt I needed to go and support somebody who is on a protest rally, and it was at 2 p.m. during a work day, all I would do is to write a note to my boss and say, I'm taking a couple of hours off this afternoon, you know, my own time. So I did it the right way. So there's no way they could say to me, how come you are at a protest rally on your work hours? So you document stuff to protect yourself. And the union was behind me. They were always supporting me, because with a strong union, you are a citizen besides being a public servant. You know, you have to do things on your own after hours. And even if it is working against the government, I'm not giving away any government secrets to anybody. I cannot stop being a human being or a citizen just because I work for a government. But one of the things I must tell you, Ilana, you know, I have, as you know, all these various recognitions, you know, Order of Canada and all the various wonderful honors. But one of the ones I'm so proud of, I want you to know, is PARC is the name of the organization. It's the Social Planning Research Council of BC. I was given an award by them. And I learned sometime later that I was nominated by BC Government Employees Union, which is my union, and the Minister of Social Services. Isn't yes. that something? A union and the government representative jointly nominated me. That has never happened before or after. So they knew that I was committed to my work. I'm not doing this to get prestige or to get name in the paper or any of that kind of stuff. I'm doing because I believe in planning social policy and bringing people together so that they can solve their own problems. And so I was really and truly touched by that, you know, through all of these years of getting recognitions. I tell you, I was really moved by the fact that I was nominated to get the Order of Canada by a First Nations woman in BC. Of course, I worked with the First Nations people for many, many years, but I never thought that I would be seen or accepted as someone worthy as a settler of some kind. And then, you know, there I am in Ottawa. Who is giving me the Order of Canada? I can cry right now, actually. A woman who came to this country as a refugee. And there I am, an immigrant. And I tell you, that's something that really makes me feel so emotional, because I just think that there aren't too many places where one can, as a public servant and also as an immigrant woman, an older woman, going to be 81 soon, right. Can take such pride in saying that, my God, they think I'm okay.
Right. And it's a real testament to the work and the years of dedication, Patsy, that you have had to work with so many different populations.
Yeah.
And I guess, as you say, like, there's an ideological underpinning that has yeah. grounded you and kept you true to yourself, no matter what yeah. the challenge yeah. was. You really put your feet where your mouth is. Because I was noticing yeah. that you were doing a 3-day fast starting
yes,
on Earth Day in April to yes. stop the purchase of fighter jets.
Exactly.
And I think you said you were representing WILP, the Women's WILP, International yes. League for Peace yeah. and Freedom. And I wanted to ask you about that and sort of yes. that part of your life.
Well, you know, I actually am very fortunate with the fact that when, as an undergraduate student, I did my undergraduate work and both my master's as well in Ontario. So I became quite active with the NDP. But to go back to the WILF, you know, I don't know whether you know this, but in 1915, when WILF was established, the first president of WILF was a woman by the name Jane Addams. Right. She was a social worker. She's considered a founder of the social work profession in North America. So as a social work student, I was exposed to this woman and her work, and she received the Nobel Peace Prize because of the work that she did. So I was exposed to WILF from years ago. I attended the 100 years anniversary at The Hague, which is where the women from across the world got together to start this movement to fight against war and for peace and freedom for women. You know, in those days, we didn't have votes. So WILF was always part of my ideological sense, and how important it is for women to come together and fight for ourselves and for the rest of the world. And And it so happened that I was fortunate to have people like Rosemary, another social worker, Margaret Mitchell, another social worker. There are a whole bunch of these women who are activists, and they were political. They were elected officials. And every 3 months or so, I would have a dinner at my house because I love cooking. So I use my cooking talents to invite a handful of people to come and have a conversation about what's going on currently and what can we do about it. Who are the people who we need to approach and which groups should come together? And I tell you, when I look back at it, it sounds like those salons that they used to have in Europe,
exactly,
you know, in Paris.
Exactly.
But, you know, it worked because these are informal meetings. And of course, I would invite the director of the School of Social Work, director of planning from the city of Vancouver. And of course, they will come. And of course, Rosemary was always there, you know, and Margaret Mitchell was always there. And people want to meet them as well. And so it was also trying to connect people with each other, you know, and I think that is also part of community organizing skills. But in my case, because I loved cooking anyway, so I was able to have a dinner party. But right. At the same time, we were connecting. And so each person then think about, oh, what can I do? What steps could I take? It was not only my job for which I got paid, but I also continued doing this kind of organizing in my social life as well. So it was not only serious fighting for various things, but we also enjoyed each other and we enjoyed life. I mean, it was like a gift. And in my case, with Rosemary, she was quite influential in me helping to organize the National Association of Immigrant and Visible Minority Women. Because you may not remember, you're younger, but I think it was in 69, thereabouts, and we had the Women's Commission and came up with all kinds of wonderful recommendations for women around our rights. But somehow that report didn't have anything to do with immigrant or women of color. Right. And that's when Rosemary and I chatted, and I brought a few people together, women of color. Some of them were lawyers, and others were teachers, and others were clerical people. All kinds. And then we decided, my goodness gracious, you know, the white women who are organizing all of this, if they don't think in terms of those of us who are new to this country or have had to fight the racism and all of that, maybe we need to gather as a group, a movement of our own selves. A group had more power than just one or two individuals. And Rosemary was very much part of that women's movement. But at the same time, she didn't have a larger immigrant visible minority women behind her as an organized sector. And so that's part of what happened. And it was interesting that even though the white women were fighting to get better salaries and better recognition and want to be in senior positions and whatnot, their children at home were being, you know, looked after by immigrant women, you know, and we were not even getting $10 or $15 an hour, which I think it was probably even less in those days. And so I don't think it was intentional, but just that they had no idea about some of these women who have come from various parts of the world, have their own professional degrees, but they were not recognized. And so they would take any jobs. So that's part of the reason it was important for me to help organize that National Association of Immigrant Visible Minority Women. I was one of 6 or 8 people who actually started that thing. And it's no longer in existence because we worked with the women's community and they included the immigrant and visible minority. And Rosemary was the only sort of a leader in that group who was already a politician at that time and who was recognized as a leader in the larger community, was able to help and support us. And one of the other things that I discovered was during that experience, the immigration department would pay a man to learn English. You know, he didn't have to pay the fees to learn English as a second language. Whereas they wouldn't pay the woman because they thought the man is the one who is the breadwinner, whereas the woman is at home. So we had to fight the government to change that policy so that women can also learn English because they're also teaching their children English as well. Part of the reason for starting the Pacific Immigrant Resources Society in BC was to support those women with preschool children who did not speak English. And their husbands, some of them didn't want them to go out to learn English, you know, whereas the men were okay about the children going to preschool. So we thought, okay, what about if we have sort of a daycare, maybe two or three afternoons a week, and ask the mothers to bring them. And then while the children are in the daycare, we can teach the women English, you see. So that's how it all happened. It's a very simple way of making sure that women had access to education, to services, and to knowledge, and to resources that were available in the community. Took a lot of fights and a lot of organizing in order to recognize that not all of us come with equal opportunities. We may have equal abilities. Many of us do, but that they're not recognized. And so in order to give them those opportunities, we have to open doors for them. And we do it together as a group. And so it isn't that I'm doing somebody a favor. What I'm doing is really assisting my own sisters so that the next generation is going to be more confident. They don't have to internalize their anger or their disappointment because their accent is laughed at or their college degrees are not recognized. It's part of how we try to bring more equality within our system, within our society. And so that's the kind of philosophy that we socialists believe in, right? It made sense for me to do that kind of work.
And it's quite stunning listening to you because it's still so relevant today. As you're speaking, I'm thinking, this is so much of what is being articulated in this moment in such a powerful way as well. And so that work is far from done.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. Well, as long as we live in a capitalist society, that kind of inequality is going to be perpetuated. And that's why it's so important for us, those of us with a left-leaning, I mean, we're not going to get rid of the capitalist system, but how can we make it possible for people to benefit, all people to benefit equally? And that's what I think we all need to work on and fight for, right?
Right. And it strikes me too, Patsy, that some of the language that is really helpful that is developing now or being used much more in the public space around white supremacy and around intersectionality, although that phrase has been around for a long time. But and the discussion, which is really important around performative allyship, just all of this language which encapsulates and challenges and brings back to the forefront of our consciousness as well. The story that you're telling.
And respecting the difference. And we are that's equal, right. But different.
Yeah. And even the story that you're telling about how white women were fighting for equal rights, but they weren't fighting for equal rights for all women. You and Rosemary and others had to come together to ensure that that was part of the
fight.
Dialogue.
Yeah, exactly.
That's still very true now.
Well, that's true. The minority communities, the cultural minority communities are certainly saying that for sure, right?
To me, listening to you talk about it is poignant and painful and how contemporary your story sounds. Absolutely not understanding that the one articulation of feminism did not apply to everyone and not making space for other voices and realities. Like, that's painful to think that you've been fighting that good fight for so long. And still, even today, we, and I include myself in that narrative, we are still in a place where that has to be fought for. And I just wonder, because you've been doing this for a long time and you've been thinking about it for a long time, how does that land for you? I mean,
you know, the sort of societal change doesn't happen overnight. That's where I think these social movements are so important. The more people learning about it, they get more educated, informed, they make it their issue. So unless that happens and the majority of the people are saying, we do not agree with racism, we do not agree with violence, not just against women, but also violence, period. And I don't think we're going to reach that perfect heaven that we're looking for. But while you're living, whether it is a short life or a long life, I think it is my duty, it's a social responsibility to keep on fighting until the end of my time. And I know that next generation will have to work on some other different issues. At least I think that we all have to fight for this kind of freedom and equality and equal opportunities for everyone, regardless of where you were born or what color your skin is and what kind of money your parents had. We should all be respected. That social responsibility is what will keep me going until my last day, you know?
Yeah, that's familiar. that sounds familiar. This isn't just history. This is your contemporary reality. I mean, we really are living in such difficult times. It really is quite extraordinary. And systemic racism and the fight against around white supremacy and a global plague that has struck the world, but also struck at the heart of inequality. And I wonder, Patsy, you know, it's a little unfair to ask, but you're the first interview I'm doing at this moment in time. But I have to say this year, I've been thinking a lot, Patsy, about, you know, we are living through such difficult and challenging times. And when I think about to whom do we turn for advice, for succor, for encouragement, I turn to older women.
Well, exactly. I was going to say the elders. Yeah. The elders, that is exactly right, because they have lived it through and they have seen changes. They have seen going back instead of going forward. And I think that one of the positive things about this time that we're living is that more and more people are acknowledging that there is inequality. That's one of the hopes that I have, that there may be more acknowledgement, and that in turn will help us to figure out or get people to support programs and policies that is going to bring more equality and change within our systems, within our structures, within our families, within our neighborhoods. I think there is a recognition that things are not all well and not everyone has the same opportunities. I think there is more of that happening now. We can't deny that that we are in this world together, you know? So there is some hope in that way. But I do think it's very important for us to look to our elders, mostly women. And I tell you, one of the things when I was a witness with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, what I spoke about is the strength of women in the First Nations community, the older women. And I felt so obliged to do the right thing, because the fact that they were saying to me, as an immigrant, a settler, and someone who has a social work as a profession, if you want to give witness to what has happened to all those people who have survived the residential schools, it was quite an honor that they were offering me. And so I really felt that I should share with them not only the racism that is so much part of our system, but also the strength of the women. And I think you can generalize that about women, period. You know, the older women in our communities, whether it is here in Canada, whether it is in Kenya, whether it is, you know, Ghana, it doesn't matter where. The older women who have lived through and have seen what has happened to their own families and their communities and learned to work with the inner strength they have to keep the families together, to support someone who is really going through a difficult period, and then fight for changes within their structures. And that's what we have seen in Africa. Those women that we have been able to work with, the foundation has been supporting, they've been able to make changes by coming together as a group, getting the governments to change policies. That's what the elder women are able to share with the younger ones and with the rest of the society, because they have lived it, they have seen it, and they have experienced it. And they are still holding the flag. They are still saying that we are in this together. We are working with the younger people. We're working with the kids, and we're working for the future generation. I really and truly believe that we have a continuing responsibility from our life experience, what we have seen and what works and what didn't work. And sometimes we can get away with it. You see, we can say things because we are an old lady, you know. People.
You've earned the right to name it. Yeah, that's right. Well, I love that. I love that. I believe that deeply, too. I believe on the other side, too, that it's also the responsibility of all of us, young ones and younger ones,
working together
to work together and to return to and respect and to seek the counsel of older women in particular.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's our responsibility, too. You feel the responsibility, as you say, to continue to be in this project of improving the human condition.
But exactly.
In the same way, those of us who are younger at all stages have to also appreciate that there's this extraordinary resource that we have to continue to seek out Yeah. This conversation simplifies exactly this last point that you've made, and I appreciate it so much, Patsy. Just to hear from you and hear your perspective and your wisdom and your long, long years of extraordinary dedication.
I feel like I'm a very ordinary person who have had opportunities and good luck in many ways to be able to move forward. So I'm eternally grateful for the fact that I was able to do that. And as I said earlier, even as a public servant, that I was able to join my personal and political as a community development perspective. Even when I'm a bureaucrat, my role is to make sure that the community, the people who are supposedly getting our services, they have some say in how things are done within the bureaucracy and bring that voice into the system and to make systems change. In my experience, I always start a pilot project. You see, everybody thought pilot projects were okay.
You are the definition of tenacious. Thank goodness you persevere.
It works, you see. Yeah. After you have the pilot project and they've discovered, oh my God, hell, well, maybe we need to change that policy, you know? This sounds like a good plan.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. I'm Ilana Landsberg-Lewis, your host of Grandmothers on the Move. If you want to find out more about me or the podcast, go to grandmothersonthemove.com and come back next week for another episode.